Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcoat Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews.
By students, for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
It's the Shortcoat Podcast. I'm Dave Etler here today with Elaine Sanduk.
Hello.
John Pienta.
Hi.
Wow. And Casey McCleary.
What's up?
To talk about whatever it is that med students want to talk about. Our podcast is a healing place, John Pienta. I know you're relatively new on the show, so let me explain that for our listeners. This is a place of serenity, of deep and vast peace, John.
We pulled him from the audience one day, and now he won't leave.
We are one with the world of medicine, and the world of medicine is one with us. Welcome, my brothers and sisters. And to you listening at home, the gym, or wherever, know that you can always contact us at theshortcoat.com and tell us what you'd like to hear about. Click on Tell Us Your Moment of Truth, and through it, release your pain to us so that you may be made whole.
Serenity now!
Whoa! Anyway, welcome back to the show. What's going on in the legislature here in Iowa, Casey McCleary?
Okay, so recently, I know there was a Physician Day on the Hill. Unfortunately, I was not able to attend, but I got to talk to some of the senators from our area.
Didn't they come visit?
They did come
the college
visit
the other day.
They did come visit the college, and I was really glad I went because one of them was sponsoring a bill to allow psychologists in Iowa, PhD-trained psychologists in Iowa, to take a class and get prescribing privileges for certain medications to expand care in Iowa. Hmm. And the Iowa Medical Association lobbied against it, and it did not move forward. And I am actually very disappointed about this. So I wanted to talk about it and see what other people's opinions were, and, of course, express my own opinions.
It would have allowed non-MDs to prescribe medication, which is, that's just not really, I guess PAs can prescribe in some.
Can they?
Yep.
In some
yep.
situations.
PAs, yeah. Nurses, registered nurses, and can physical therapists for anything? I can't remember.
I don't know if they can. But
I can't remember if they can.
So these professions can, but not PhDs now.
But not PhDs,
well,
psychologists.
Ever, so far.
Yes. Hmm. Okay. I think three states have approved it, and Illinois is one of them, and that was very recently. And I think that's some of what's really bringing it to the forefront in Iowa.
And so what's the reason that the Iowa AMA lobbied against it?
My impression is that they don't think that psychologists have enough training, and they don't think the training programs would be extensive enough for it to be safe, because psychiatric patients do tend to have a lot of comorbidities, and so a lot of people who are on antidepressants are also going to be on, like, high cholesterol medications or you know, a variety of other medications. Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the big concerns is about potential interactions, and since psychologists don't have that big background, they might not be as good at it. Hmm.
Can you tell us more about this class that they're supposed to take that would qualify them to do that?
I don't know what it would be like in Iowa. I know that in other states, I think it's like a couple months online. If we have a break in the show, I can look more into it. Yeah, so basically,
I'm trying to look it up, and I'm really not seeing anything worthy of talking
yeah.
about. But
I don't know.
So maybe they may in fact have not even come up with, like, the class that would be taken. It's just, you know, sort of like, let's move forward on this kind of discussion.
That was my impression. I don't know that there are specific plans laid out for, like, this class would be exactly like this and this is what they would learn. But it's more like an initiative to at least have the conversation, even.
Well, it would be insanely complicated. I mean, you have to admit, it would be insanely complicated for any physician to deal with the medical implications of the comorbidities and things like that. But
sure, but
it can be. I mean, if they I don't know.
Well, my perspective is that, yeah, that's a totally valid concern. That's something that the class would have to deal with, and they would only be prescribing very particular medications, a very small set of medications, relatively small. There's this magical thing called the internet now where you can just have an app on your iPad and look up all of the medical interactions. Also, you can call pharmacists if you have any concerns, if you have a really complicated case. My other thought is that these psychologists would not generally be dealing with the really severe psychiatric cases, with the really complicated cases. They would generally be filling a need for people who need, like, generic antidepressants, but are in a rural community and can't get all the way in to see a psychiatrist. Already, the leading prescriber of things like antidepressants and anxiolytics are primary care physicians. And I think that even though they have really great training in a lot of cases, that's not their specialty. And I mean, I think it's reasonable that someone with PhD level counseling training could also step up and be trained to handle that particular prescribing privilege.
Sure.
Yeah, I think the really important thing to consider is that, you know, the evidence shows that, that medications are good, that counseling is good, but when combined together, you get a kind of synergistic effect, and it ends up being more, really ultimately more effective for the patient.
Exactly. And then you get continuity of care. You're not bouncing back and forth. You have one person who gives you your depression medication and one person who gives, and the same person who gives you your depression therapy.
And primary care providers are frankly not trained and don't have the time to do, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, acceptance and commitment therapy, any of the kinds of modalities that I think have been shown to be just as effective as medications, or, and in this case, you know, synergistic with medication.
I'm afraid to disagree because I don't like confrontation, but my feelings...
No, go for it.
Yeah, you fight me. Come on.
That's why we're here.
Bring it. Let's discuss.
Yeah. Well, I like the idea of the physician being the captain on the ship of healthcare. And I do feel like there has to be someone in charge, someone leading the healthcare team. And I am afraid that if you give drug privileges to psychologists who don't have, like, the physician level training to know how to prescribe these medicines, how people will react to them, how they interact. I mean, it's extremely complex, and even we don't fully understand how they work.
How, okay, so
you go through medical school. Don't pull it that
so,
thread.
No.
Don't
my
pull it the
no.
We don't know how it works thread.
Well, I
mean, yeah, I shouldn't have said anything.
No good will come of this.
Let's
That's a whole different conversation.
I want to go there.
Because this is a primer.
Let's go to, you know, so you're done with medical school. You've finished your residency. You know, you're a real doctor now. A lot of it is algorithms, right? I mean, you're not like delving into, when you're prescribing something to somebody, you're not ordinarily delving into the, say, biochemistry of it, right? I mean, you know, so.
No, but I think most, that's definitely true.
I mean, most physicians, my impression is that, you know, you have like 20 or maybe even less, but like between 20 and 30 drugs that you know really, really well that are like your go-tos.
Yeah.
And you know them backwards and forwards. They're your best friends. You know
right.
how they act. You know how they're supposed to act. You know how people act on them. But
so why could psychologists not learn the same 20 or 30 drugs?
Because they don't get the basic science training that we get, I think. I mean, like, we understand how these, or supposedly we understand how these drugs work at, like, the most fundamental level. But I feel like a psychologist's conventional expertise and the expertise that you need to be able to prescribe a drug and know how it's supposed to act are too disparate.
Mm-hmm. I disagree. I think the greatest education is experiential and not didactic. Having taken pharmacology, and I know it'll be a little different for the first years, but having taken our pharmacology, I mean, we had 3 lectures on antidepressants. That's going to be my, you know, that's what people like the IMS and the AMA are going to take to Congress and say, you know, we have better training than you do.
Yeah.
Really? Like, I mean, technically, we had a class called antidepressants.
But then the other training you have, though, is as a resident, in your clerkships. I mean, you have experience. I think it would be wrong, probably, to, you know, say, okay, on the basis of what, a year's worth of classes, maybe, let's 6 months. I don't know how long, what sort of practical length of time any class would be, but, you know, on the basis of this one class, you know, now you can prescribe. I mean, it seems to me like there should be some sort of similar supervision exercise that you have to go through until you can be like, okay, now you're ready to prescribe on your own. At a minimum, that's what I would.
Like, would there be a clinical component maybe to that?
Yeah.
But I think they get a lot of that, like, sort of human interaction, decision-making training in their psychological training. And a lot of my impression is that a lot of the training that psychiatrists get when they're in the clinic is for those much more severe cases and for people who will be fully institutionalized, at least for some amount of time. And that is not, at least in my opinion, the need that this handful of people who would get prescribing privileges is meant to fill.
It seems like you could work in some sort of tier system, you know, sort of like the call center. You know, when you call, you know, when my phone is broken and I call, this may be a terrible analogy. When my phone is broken, you know, I call Apple or whoever and I say my phone is broken. You know, I don't get I don't get Tim Cook on the phone. You know, I get the guy at the bottom who's like, okay, turn off your phone and turn it back on. That's okay, that didn't reasonable. Work. And then you go, and then if that doesn't work in theory, and that if that doesn't work, you go to the next tier where they're like, okay, you know, do this more complicated step, and then you go to the next level. You know, you escalate. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, I've noticed this in other professions too, other healthcare professions, where it would be great to establish this sort of tier system where, you know, like, you know, 90% of problems could be worked out by this tier of mm-hmm. people, and then you move up to the.
But that is what happens.
I mean, yeah,
that
exactly.
Is what ideally happens, and then you have people in the emergency room for a broken nail mm-hmm. because they can't get a primary care. Not a broken nail, but you know, because they can't get a primary care physician.
Yeah.
That's not entirely inaccurate. Broken nail.
Did you literally see a broken nail?
Well,
in the emergency room?
I used to work as a paramedic, I have in fact had someone call 911 for a Band-Aid.
Wow.
Really? I am absolutely not kidding you.
Okay. Did they get it? Did they get their Band-Aid?
We gave them a Band-Aid, and we wanted to get out of there before we figured out. I was in a very, very bad area.
Drive by and throw it out the window on your way by?
No, we went to their door, and they refused to open the door, and they demanded a Band-Aid.
Oh, my God, that's so sketchy.
So the guy I was working with said, give him the Band-Aid, and let's get out of here before we find out what's on the other side of that door.
Sounds totally reasonable to me. I have no problem with it.
So, but the fragmentation of care thing, I think, you know, in an ideal world, you know, when we're talking about widgets and stuff like that, there's an evidence base that says, hey, look, we can put people through this sort of pyramid where we go, here's the lowest tier, problem solving, you know, unplug, plug it back in, turn it on, turn it off, you know, that kind of stuff. And I think partly that works because there's so much supply and so much demand. Whereas, you know, and also, you know, you have these very sort of replaceable items. But I mean, if you look at human people, it's much harder to split this up like that.
It's an imperfect analogy, I admit.
Here's my
No, but I like the idea. And I mean, you have to ask yourself, so why do they do it that way? And the reason why we don't do it that way is I think the structured system doesn't exist. We don't communicate within our own system nearly efficiently enough to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, history of medicine, medicinally speaking, like healthcare has been very fragmented, and only recently has come into these more centralized things like hospitals and care systems and HMOs and big groups, and even those are still in a lot of cases operating kind of separately. So we have this very like piecemeal system. It wasn't built up as systematically.
Like a lot of systems, a lot of systems. If you could build them from the ground up over again, you would do it in a different way than they are.
So many things.
Anyway, Aline, you wanted to say something. Sorry.
I'm all for the democratization of healthcare and the expansion of duties onto, you know, more than one health profession so that you can increase access to care. Mm-hmm. But I just want to clarify that it's not that I don't think psychologists are capable of doing this. I think this just comes from like a very deep-seated fear that I have of drugs that affect the brain. And
it's pretty sketchy.
It's very, very scary. And, you know, I've seen things happen to other people, and I know that in my profession, personally, I will be extremely skeptical about prescribing medicines that act on the brain, because you're giving someone a medicine that affects the very organ that they use to judge how that medicine is affecting the very organ that is used to judge how that, you know what I mean? Like, so even with my training, I will still treat that with the utmost hesitation and skepticism, and to put that in the hands of someone who has even less, as little training as I have, it scares me. It really scares me.
I think it scares a lot of people.
It's probably best.
It's why there's some pushback. And yeah, it's definitely something to be concerned about. Ideally, the class would deal with that. But I mean, like, do you think that all of the time, all of the years that we've spent studying, like, biochemistry and all of those molecular mechanisms, like, how much impact do you think that's really going to have on our clinical prescribing practices? And, like,
I suspect it would come into play, like, when you've got like some sort of medical mystery, when you've got some sort of really complicated situation going on, and so your algorithms have failed you.
Yeah, or if you're doing research, which a lot of clinicians do.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I'm just wondering, like, is that so necessary if you're just going to have this really narrow prescriptive window and then sort of almost a referral system for if you're like, I'm out of my water? Because I mean, I think these people are hopefully going to go into it with a similar amount of respect. I think the legislators that I talked to said there were only maybe 5 people in Iowa who were really interested in doing this. So, well, I mean,
sort of begs the question,
well,
why bother? But okay.
Well, but I mean, if it were a possibility, you might get more people who were able to do that.
Yeah, if you build it, they will come.
What?
Sorry. I'll let you finish, but
go for it.
To sort of finish my thought, like, I
okay, Kanye.
Hope that I'm gonna let you finish, but that's our other thing to talk about. But you know, like, ideally, these people would also approach it with a similar amount of respect. And I mean, psychologists get a lot of training about sort of being sensitive, almost like really appreciating human beings, and a lot of people who self-select into that field really appreciate human beings. And I mean, there's going to be a liability that comes along with these prescribing privileges, and I like to think that people would, especially psychologists, would go into that not all willy-nilly,
and
would really self-select to want to do it for the good and be able to tell when it's maybe not going to be for the good, and they can step back and send that person to another person with more training.
Sure. The other thing that scares me is that, and those are all really good points, I think people who enter the health professions in general, especially psychology, have an inherent desire to help others, and they probably recognize, you know, the limits of their own knowledge. The other fear that I was thinking of is that it expands the market for antidepressant pharmaceutical companies, and it puts even more money in those people's pockets, whereas they already have plenty.
I mean, I'm not a fan of that, just as a general thing, but that's more of an anti-capitalist, dare I say it, stance than an actual, like,
medical necessity,
medical reason to deny prescribing privileges.
Yeah. I don't know. It's very complicated.
Free market, Aline. Come on. Gosh.
Just take out the middleman. Just take out the doctor. Let everyone be on antidepressants.
Damn hippies.
Well, I mean, that's why we have commercials that are like, ask your doctor about.
Yeah.
Which we shouldn't. We shouldn't have commercials like that for pharmaceuticals.
Yeah.
Ask your doctor.
That's my next opinion.
Your doctor does not want you to ask.
And we've already established your doctor doesn't know.
Your doctor
is. Your doctor's like, what is this drug? I looked it up. Oh, it has like a statistically significant but not clinically significant effect. No, you're not going on it.
That the drug company told me about.
Do you want a free pen, though? They gave me all these free pens.
We'll be back in just a second on the Short Coat Podcast.
The Art of Medicine podcast explores topics in medicine through the lens of the arts and social sciences. Learn about an epileptic woman who created a virtual reality grand mal seizure, what doctors can learn from jazz musicians, and the experience of sexual assignment in a medicalized body. Download us on iTunes and visit us at www.theartofmedicinepodcast.com. We are a member of the Vocalis Network, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
Welcome back to the Short Coat Podcast. Last week, we noted the unfortunate truncation of not only a Royal Marine's leg, but of his tattoo, which ended up reading, "You will never walk." And we've surely seen the tattoos that signaled their wearer's belief that we should regret knowing. But sometimes... But sometimes we do regret hings, you know? Luckily for those people, there is a silotion on the horizon. Alec Falkenham is a PhD student at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and he says he's come up with a topical cream that does what the body can't, make the offending tattoo fade away. The Dalhousie, I think that's how you're pronounced. I think that's how one...
As the resident Canadian, I think you're right.
Maybe, okay.
The Canadian?
I was born in Canada, yeah.
Whoa.
How have we not talked about this?
No, I don't know.
The Dalhousie, we'll talk after.
We should hang out more.
Yeah, maybe after.
What are you hitting at there?
The Dalhousie press release explains it this way, and I'm hoping that one of you can explain it to me better, because I didn't quite get it. The tattoo is basically ink injected into the skin, which is then consumed by macrophages, right? Some macrophages carry the ink particles away through the lymphatic system. Others dive deeper into the skin after they've consumed the ink and stay there, inactive, being eaten over and over by new macrophages, and with the ink sort of just staying there. Is it?
Oh, tattoos are so much cooler than I ever realized.
I mean, that's why they stay, you know, like, because some, I don't know, that's what I got out of this article. Anyway, so is that an accurate...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how it works.
Sounds reasonable to me.
So Falkenham's technology targets the leftover macrophages by smearing them with liposomes. More macrophages then come to get rid of the liposomes and take the old inky macrophages too, I guess. Huh. So I thought that was interesting, especially that his invention has gotten so much attention following the news release, that the editor's note on the Dalhousie press release says that while he's grateful for the attention, he's really not looking for volunteers yet, which to me says there's a metric ton of people out there with regrettable tattoos. Mm-hmm. I just want to welcome Ethan Forsgren to the...
Hi.
He was just hanging around, and I said, sit.
The conversation was so stimulating.
Yeah.
I just had to sit down.
Oh, fantastic.
Can we put that quote on our website?
Yes.
The conversation was so stimulating.
I will.
I had to sit down.
I was overwhelmed. I was swept off my feet, literally.
Carry on.
He has nothing better to do. That's what he really means.
All right. So new study shows that humans can only see about 30 shades of gray, give or take a few, as opposed to 50.
What about shades of spousal abuse? What about shades of porn?
I
think humans have proved they can see plenty shades of porn.
I guarantee that people can see more than 50 shades of porn, and they don't know what it is, but they know it when they see it.
I think there's only 34 shades of porn.
Oh, well.
Wow. Have you done the research?
It's out there.
All right.
Is that based on rule 34?
What's rule 34?
Oh, God.
John?
You should Google it.
If it can be made into porn, then...
It probably exists. It has been already.
And it exists on the internet.
Okay. So anytime you mention something...
I see what you're saying.
In a porn context, now it exists on the internet.
I see.
Yeah. There was actually... in a recent episode, I think, of Snap Judgment, I don't know if you guys listen to that podcast on NPR, but they were talking about artificial intelligence, and they ended up talking to a guy who worked at a unnamed social networking company, and his job was to basically go through the results that were pulled by their algorithm of what is questionable content and kind of go through and be like, yes, computer, you got this right. No, computer, you got this wrong. And it was talking about the ethical problems that, you know, he was dealing with, that where he couldn't delete content himself. He could only delete content that was pulled by the computer. And so sometimes it would pull, you know, not really legitimately pornographic things, but other times there were things that needed to be taken down that the computer didn't recognize.
Oh. Oof.
I thought that was very interesting.
Interesting.
There are a lot of ways of removing pornographic content from various things on the internet or from various like filters. Like, there are tons of companies that do it. There's this thing called Mechanical Turk that's run by Amazon, and
so
it'll just pull up a whole bunch of random pictures, and it's like, mark if you can see like a butt crack, and then it gets marked.
No way.
Yeah, and you get paid like 5 cents to do a handful of pictures.
Really?
It's pretty crazy.
Like, basically incorporating human judgment and merging it with this algorithm.
So, wait, your job in that case would be to sit there and look for pictures of naked people, for instance, and flag them. That's what you do.
It gives you examples of like, this level of nudity is too much. And then you go through the pictures that it gives you, and you're like, this, and this.
Is this very similar to like facial recognition software that like the more times you tell it it's you on Facebook, the better it is that Facebook is at recognizing you?
I don't know. It doesn't give you that much details about what you're doing. Like, it literally, you just get paid like 10 cents, and it's like, do exactly this.
Interesting.
This sounds like a great job for medical students who are looking for a little extra cash, don't you think? No.
It
sounds,
they have a whole bunch of other like random stuff. They have like 5 second like transcriptions, or like 2 minute transcriptions, or like random surveys that you can fill out for a quarter.
Well, so this guy started,
it's kind of fun.
Yeah, it's a decent way to make money. But this guy started talking about how he started seeing the content in his dreams. Like, he would start having nightmares about some of the awful stuff he would see. And then eventually he, you know, declined to renew his contract, and he started, it's hard to describe, but basically he described a scenario where he was having breakfast with a friend of his and saw some weird guy walking down the street with his camera phone pointed at the behinds of some teenage girls, and in his mind he made the association of this guy like having been at the end of the spectrum where he saw the pictures end up on Facebook. Now he saw the kind of person who was responsible for this, and he jumped out of his seat and chased after the guy and told him to stop, and like had to shut down this like vigilante nature that he developed.
I don't know. I kind of, I would like to see more people chasing down jerks with camera phones, taking voyeuristic pictures and telling them to knock at the,
why is it socially unacceptable to chase after people doing that? I wish more people spoke up.
Yeah, but we need that. We need that kind of activism.
I think people would be afraid to be wrong, though. I mean,
but also that job is not for the squeamish, apparently.
But I think that's the thing about the internet, right? Like, you don't risk the kind of repercussions that might become you if somebody filed a lawsuit or something. That's kind of what's so fascinating for me about the internet more at large, is that you see like social movements develop so much faster because, in a way, people aren't risking as much.
That's a good point.
And in some cases, that's awesome. And in some cases, it's terrible. And lots of people get their information spilled out onto the internet.
Yeah, it's kind of polarizing. You can go both ways, right? I mean,
the internet can be beautiful or it can be really bad.
Like the bathroom wall at your high school.
No, that's pretty much just bad, usually.
I don't remember anybody saying
proto-internet was the bathroom wall. Some people wrote beautiful poetry and some people less so.
Actually, that's kind of like Reddit. Bathroom wall is like old school Reddit.
Yeah, that's true. Actually. That's or 4chan. On.
No. Yeah, probably.
4chan is the toilet bowl of the internet.
The armpit is the one that I've heard. I like toilet bowl, though.
Oh. I've heard far more inappropriate.
It's much more depraved than an armpit, but in any case.
Do you want to hear what I learned about this week?
Yes.
This week I learned about exploding head syndrome.
Yes, that is a thing. I've seen someone be diagnosed with that.
Oh, really?
Oh, wow.
And that's all I can tell you.
I'd not heard of it. Exploding head syndrome, we'll call it EHS, dates back to the 1870s when it was first described in a paper on sleep disorders. And the name was coined more than 100 years later in an article in Lancet. EHS syndromes include a sense that there's been an explosion in the head or a sudden loud noise during sleep or at the wake-sleep transition. It's harmless, but it's frightening. It's sometimes accompanied by flashes of light or heat or other physical sensations. At first, EHS was thought to be rare, but more and more accounts and studies have been published. The German journal Somnologie, which, I don't know, looks French to me.
Use a French, yeah.
Yeah. Somnologie.
The study of sleep.
Estimated that 14% of psych patients, 10% of sleep disordered patients, 11% of healthy people have experienced EHS. Researchers think EHS originates in the brainstem reticular formation, which has roles in sensory motor reflexes, motor control, and sleep. So,
we know all about that, don't we, Casey?
Oh, yeah. Or at least supposedly. I'm going to by the time I go to take my test tonight.
Absolutely.
By the way, in German, the G is a hard G, so it's Somnologie.
Somnologie. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. I knew that, actually.
That's my linguistics limit for the day.
I failed you, Germans.
I'll let them know that you're remorseful.
Yeah, what were the symptoms again?
Yeah. You hear or feel like there has been an explosion inside your head.
Okay. And it scares people. They think they're having a stroke.
Or like another
snapping
sensation or, you know, basically a loud noise within your head.
It's kind of curious that the name, I mean, so many medical terms kind of lean on the cautious side of being
neurology syndromes are hilarious.
And this kind of takes it to the other extreme. This is like exploding head syndrome. I mean, I wouldn't want to be diagnosed with
it that. It conjures up a rather different image from what it really is. But
yeah.
It also...
I think it's better, though, than, you know, like brainstem reticular formation activation syndrome or something.
Spontaneous activation syndrome. Which would get an acronym.
Yeah.
As does everything.
Mm.
Other fun neurology syndromes, alien hand syndrome.
Oh, I love that one.
Not so much fun to have, I think.
I love that one.
So there's damage to a particular part of your cortex, I want to say.
Corpus callosum, maybe? Is that the way where the...
Mm-hmm. Is it your corpus callosum? I don't think so. I don't think so.
Okay.
Nice try. Anyway.
What can I say? I'm not a doctor. Jeez. Leave me alone.
I'm trying really hard, you guys.
It started with a C.
I'm trying to be smart.
Anyway, so there's damage to a particular part of your brain, and one of your arms just sort of has a mind of its own, and whenever you're not thinking about it, it will just go off and do its own thing. Grabbing is really a problem, so like sometimes you'll walk into a room and your hand will, you'll turn on the light switch consciously, and then your hand is going to decide that it's going to turn off the light switch, so it'll just like fly up and flip off the light switch.
And I've read that a common feature is that the alien hand contradicts whatever it is the non-alien hand, I guess, wants to do. Hmm. On a case. So, you know, like you said, the turning off the light switch. Well, you know, if you turn on the light switch, the alien hand might reach out and turn it off right after you did it if you're not paying attention, which I think is pretty cool.
That's so trippy.
Yeah.
It's really strange. And I mean, the best thing I think that people have found to do is to distract the hand. Just have something to fidget with. And that, like, that's the best. There's no, I don't know that there's any
stupid alien hand. How easily
cure
fooled.
Or
when not an alien hand, you do have like conscious control over it, right?
Yeah, you can make it do things, but then as soon as you stop thinking
stop
about
focusing
it,
on it. Okay.
It's like, I'm going to change the channel. I'm going to grab this person next to me. I'm going to like wave at someone I've never met before. Like,
wow.
It just sort of does its own thing.
Forgive me. I don't have control over this hand. It has a mind of its own.
Oh, God.
Ethan, I've noticed you're pretty jacked. You got some big muscles, you know what I'm saying?
I've seen a lot of people with bigger around here.
I'm going to do DVIP bench press.
I will, but
I'm sure I'll be outbenched.
Your giant muscles lead me to believe that you've been consuming breast milk in your quest to pack on muscle, am I right?
You know, I haven't gone back to that for a while, but
it's
been a while.
I have a feeling that what you might say next might encourage me.
You should try it. According to abcnews.com, abcnews.go.com, which I hate
that's,
that.
That's how you know it's legitimate.
HBO Go.
In its never-ending quest to inform and educate, tells us that bodybuilders have been debating online about the use of human breast milk as a bodybuilding supplement. Of course, there are a number of problems with the idea, including that the one person quoted in the one so-called expert in the quoted in the article is like, yeah, that doesn't happen that often. But anyway, ABC News life.go.com went with it. Breast milk, other problems include the fact that breast milk only has 2.5 grams of protein per cup versus almost 8 for cow's milk. You know, also, unless the bodybuilder has a lactating human nearby, they have to order it from somewhere, usually online. One recent study found close to 90% of breast milk purchased over the internet hadn't been shipped properly and arrived above freezing temperatures, thus risking contamination. Another found high counts of staph bacteria in internet milk.
In internet milk? Is that what we're calling it now?
Yes.
Yikes. Amazon
milk. I want to see where you milk the internet.
Rule 34.
Oh, God.
I love a cow's milk, by the way.
Me too.
Does anybody else feel the depth of love that I do for cow's milk?
I didn't drink cow's milk growing up.
It's not common in many cultures, I think, right? I
mean, well, Canada's not.
Well, no, like actually, that's not true. I did, but we also drank goat's milk.
Oh, delicious.
It's actually very good for you. It's very nutritious.
I don't know that I've ever had a glass of goat's milk, but I mean...
It's different, but I mean, it's all dairy. And the point is, like, if you talk to a lot of dermatologists and gastroenterologists now, they'll say that a lot of the skin and GI problems that people are experiencing is due to certain types of dairy and like very subtle allergic reactions to dairy and the products that we put in dairy.
Worth it.
I mean, cow's milk is really has really been selectively designed by evolution for millions of years for the exact needs of baby cows.
Yeah.
Whoa.
That's what my
mind here.
This is what my wife argues. She thinks it's gross that adults shouldn't be drinking milk from breasts or udders.
I mean, a lot of like evolutionarily speaking, it's kind of strange that that adult humans drink milk of any sort, but especially cow milk. But well, people of European descent in particular have sort of gained this tolerance over time.
And I have read that it's a very, in terms of evolution, you know, it's a very recent addition to the abilities of humans to be able to digest milk at all.
That's true.
But got no problems with cheese, so bring on the cheese.
I love cheese. If you put me on a desert island for 10 years and I could only pick one thing to eat it would be cheese.
Oh my God, me too.
But I'd
let's get lost on a desert island together.
Yes. After school.
American. Okay.
After graduation.
This summer?
An island composed of
cheese island.
Oh my God.
Cheese American island. Processed cheese.
We could live
how about that?
On an island made of cheese, Casey.
Poor digestive system. Wait, are we going to have arguments about what type of cheese or can we have like different cheese?
Yeah,
trees?
Could we have different kinds of cheese? No
cheese
scales.
Bushes.
I don't want to know my weight during this.
All right.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, scales. Different
just
kinds
cheese.
Of cheese. Like the mountains might be Parmesan and the
yeah.
lakes.
Big island.
The lakes might be
a Brie lake.
Brie.
An extra creamy Brie lake. Oh.
I would accept a yogurt lake, too.
I'm just going to mentally check out for 5 minutes and fantasize about that.
And perhaps trees that provide laxatives, because I think
that's
might
a solid
I think
plan.
That might become a problem.
The literal land of milk and honey.
Oh. Sounds like a bad theme park.
Seriously, though,
dairy
can we make
land.
That happen?
Okay. It's on its way.
Fantastic.
Consider it done.
I don't think we have enough sponsors for that yet.
Brought to you by the American Dairy Farmers Association.
You guys, scientists have pondered the genetic basis of humans' special abilities of abstract thought, language, complicated emotions, and logic.
Oh, did they solve that?
No, yeah, apparently. We know that we have both larger brains and more interconnected neural structures than, say, chimps, for example, with which we share about 95% of our DNA. This is what we all know. Scientists from Duke University Medical School looked at the remaining 5% and focused on an area of the genetic code adjacent to another bit known to be connected to brain development. They took that bit out and put it into mouse embryos. They did the same for the same version of the chimp DNA, put that into mice. And they found that just before mice were born with the human DNA, they had 12% larger brains than the mice with the chimp DNA.
Mm. Wow.
So this is kind of a big deal because it's worth noting that the DNA for embiggening brains was found among what was once thought of as junk DNA. We know that these areas that they don't code for proteins are probably responsible for turning genes on and off. But
junk DNA is one of those terms that in like 100 or 200 years, people are just going to think it's hilarious, and they're going to be like, oh, those idiots thought all we had all this stuff that didn't do anything.
Yeah, I think we already have a good precedent for showing that junk DNA is junk science.
Yeah.
And that you're able to do really, really interesting things with those, you know, strange sort of random seeming repeats and weird spacings and things like that allow DNA to coil in three dimensions and things that we haven't really even looked at. I mean, we pretty much look at analysis of the DNA as a string of letters. We don't think about what the superposition of those letters within the cell actually means.
You should do research.
I think what's particularly cool about this this news, though, is this is only one aspect of, you know, brain development, is having bigger ones, you know, with more neurons or whatever. Yeah. I mean, this doesn't mean anything in particular at this point, except that we suddenly know how to make larger mouse brains.
Yeah. I mean, that's that kind of correlates with the difference, partly. I think we have larger brains than monkeys, say, on, like, for our body size.
Yes.
So it kind of correlates, but did they see any different behavior in the mice?
Well, I don't think that I don't think they allowed the mice to be born. So this is like step one, I guess.
Okay. Yeah,
I don't know. Like,
why not just
let it? You know, I don't know. I guess they had to pick a point
like
where they
do other cruel things to mice all the time. I mean, why not just let it be born?
Or perhaps they had to pick a point at which to measure it, and they decided that the best point was before it was born. But yeah, I mean, the next step is to allow the mice to live for a while and see, you know, if they, you know, compose sonnets. I don't know what they might do next.
Put them on a keyboard and let them type Shakespeare.
Yes. As usual, we're a long way off from knowing what effects simply having a bigger brain. And of course, there are ethical problems, but I would love to I think it would be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, that's some Flowers for Algernon stuff right there.
I would like it.
Pretty soon you'll have little Stuarts walking around.
Aww. Yeah. Mm. Oh, that's cute.
I like the sound of that.
The movie, anybody?
I think a lot of people don't like the idea of hyper-intelligent mice.
No,
or
yeah.
Or rodents of any sort.
It would be a clear problem.
Or mice running restaurants. Like,
because now you can't kill them in good conscience.
And they serve cheese.
And French cuisine.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh.
We are going to have the best island.
Yes.
We are out of time for the week.
Oh, bummer.
I know.
It's no.
Back next week for mouse cheese.
Yes. Yes. Thank cheese you guys island. For coming.
Food
for
Thanks thought. For having us.
Yeah, all right. If you liked what you heard on the Short Code Podcast today, leave us a review and some stars on iTunes or Stitcher. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to tell us your moment of truth. If something strange or wonderful happened to you, if you're annoyed or pleased about something, or if you want to suggest a story idea to us, leave us a message at theshortcode.com. Do follow and talk to us on Twitter so we can all stay up to date on what's happening at the margins of medicine. The show is made possible by this strange world we live in and a generous donation by the Carver College of Medicine Student Government and the Writing and Humanities Program. Our executive producer is Jason Lewis. Our intern is Corey Christensen. Our opening music is by Dr. Vox. It's called Heatstroke. It's new this week. And our closing music is by C2C. Talk to you in a week.